Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today our special guest is Ralph Ellis. Ralph has written numerous books detailing pretty much the history of Egypt, but not as you know it. It's got more to do with the fact that we don't really know the history of certain parts of Egypt because they are parts of other traditions like the Jewish history. And specifically why we've got Ralph on today is because in the news last week was a story about how King Tut, Tutankhamun, one of the most famous boy kings and most famous pharaohs ever, might be Western European in origin. The story of this goes like as follows. The Discovery Channel was interviewing Zahi Hawass, and during the interview with the man who runs the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt, they saw a piece of paper which the camera photographed, and it didn't get discussed into the Discovery Channel broadcast as such, but somebody has basically seen what is there, recaptured that result, and then interpreted the DNA findings which were visible on that screen. And the end results are that there seems to have been a DNA analysis of King Tut, and that DNA analysis shows that, in essence, the area in the world where his type of DNA comes from is specifically Western Europe, and specifically places like Ireland and Scotland, and basically all the countries which look out to the Atlantic Ocean. Now, that is very interesting because in legend there is a story of Queen Scotia, who abandoned Egypt at the time of Akhenaten and Nefertiti, and found refuge eventually in Ireland and later on in Scotland, and how Scotland was named after her. So, Ralph, with that kind of topical news item, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much for the introduction. And yes, I'm look forward to the interview. I'm glad to be on the show.
I just want to jump in here for a minute and talk to our listeners and say I have been a huge fan of your work for such a long time. I have read so many of your books, and specifically, you know, my Irish girl fascination with Scotia is what first introduced me to your work. And you had written, you know, for my money, the most thorough and most interesting and most exciting book about the subject. So that's how I first came to know your work, was through you that I really came to understand the connection between Egypt and the Celtic countries. So I'm very excited to talk to you today. I have so many questions. I think that starting with this sort of topical nature of the Tut discovery is a really good introduction for our readers who are listeners and readers who are new to this idea of there being a connection between the Egyptians and the Western Europeans. So with this discovery of Tut, which the discovery says his DNA is 99.6% match with Western European Y chromosomes. What does that mean to you? Where does that take you based on your research?
That was very interesting because it confirms everything I wrote in that particular book, Scota, Egyptian Queen of the Scots. The Scota story has been touched on by a few books, but I didn't think in enough detail. So I went to have a look at the history of Queen Scota, and it was very interesting because it states that Queen Scota was an Egyptian princess. She was married to a Greek prince, and they ruled Egypt for a short time. And then they were pushed out on an exodus. There was some sort of civil war, of course. And they went to Spain, and later they went to Ireland and Scotland. The king and queen were called Scota and Gaethlos. And from Scota and Gaethlos, we get the Scottish and Gaelic people. That is the story. And this is a very ancient story, of course. This goes back to the ancient Irish book of the Labor Gabala. That's about 500 AD. And the Scottish Scotichronicon. And that's about sort of 1300 AD. So this is a very ancient tradition in that part of the world. And I thought it needed some more investigation, as I always do in all of my books. I sort of investigate, research the topic, and it's surprising what can be found when you start, you know, looking in depth. And yeah, that was quite an interesting story.
Well, I find that for people who are new to these ideas, they tend to say, oh, this is mythology. These are medieval inventions. We hear that with these stories. We hear it with biblical stories. This tends to be the sort of normal caveat with this. Oh, well, it's mythology. It was invented by people in the Middle Ages.
And of course, with King Arthur as well, exactly the same.
And of course, there seems to be a complete disregard for the idea that all of these legends had to have come from somewhere. And one of the things that I admire so much about your work is that you go and find the sources of these stories. You are not content to say, this is a legend. You have done so much digging to go back to original source material and say, this is where it comes from. I did not know that there was such a thing as the Scotochronicon until I read your book, for example.
Yes.
Can you just give our listeners a little bit of the story of Scotia and Gaethelos and what that actually looks like?
Yes, and just following on from what you said there, it's rather surprising that these subjects are not actually taught in Ireland and Scotland. So, you know, the next generation coming along through the education system over there do not know of Scota and Gaethelos, whether it's mythology or not. Surely it is right to teach them about the presumed, quotes, mythological history of that part of the world, but they don't. And so I started looking into it, and of course it's a very old tradition, and the thing that surprised me is it's very accurate. You know, they say it's mythology, and I've always believed that there was a good reason for writing mythology. It has to be based on something, and when I read the Scotochronicon, it was based on real fact. And the fact it was based on was basically Manetho's History of Egypt. So whoever was writing this mythology, as they say, in Ireland and Scotland, had a copy of Manetho's History of Egypt, because it's identical. And that made me look further, because obviously there was some real history within these stories. And it pointed... through this history, it pointed precisely at the Amarna Age, that the Amarna Age being the era of Akhenaten and Nefertiti. And if you look at the precise history that it gives in Scotochronicon, it identifies Scota as being the daughter of Pharaoh Akhenaten. And the daughter I think that we are looking for is actually Ankhesenamun. And surprisingly, because this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, Ankhesenamun was the wife of Tutankhamun. So she was his widow. And from what I've gleaned, because the history of Egypt is not entirely clear at this point, but from what I've gleaned, Ankhesenamun married Ai. So he became Pharaoh Ai, and he was probably her uncle. He was much older than she was. And their rule over Egypt ended. Now, it's presumed that they were killed, like they say Akhenaten was killed. But there is no evidence for this. We have no tomb of Ai. We have no tomb of Ankhesenamun. So it's entirely possible that what Scotochronicon is saying is actually correct. There was an uprising, that there was a civil war. Egypt was taken over by the next pharaoh, who was an army commander. That was Horemheb. So what happened to Ankhesenamun and Pharaoh Ai? Well, Scotochronicon says that they were pushed out of Egypt on an exodus. And this wasn't just a fleeing from Egypt. It was quite apparent that they were given a fleet of ships and said and told to, you know, go on your way. We don't want you anymore. Off you go. Remember, it was very difficult in those days for an uprising to kill a king, a pharaoh, because they were sons of God. So the next obvious thing is just to send them off on an exodus. And that's exactly what Scotochronicon says that happened. So they went on this quite large exodus. I'm estimating around 50 ships. And they sailed off to Spain. Initially.
Can I interrupt you and ask you just one question for clarification? So are you saying then that Pharaoh Ai and Gaethelos are the same person?
Yes. Now, this is not entirely clear. The texts say that Gaethelos was a Greek prince, He came from Greece. Now, this is rather confusing because we don't know of any Greek princes who arrived in Egypt at that time because Greece didn't really exist at that time. We're talking 1300 BC here. Greece was not an established state at that point. I think the confusion that has happened here is because the texts of Manetho say that I, who was also known as Danaus, went to Greece. So at some point in his career, I went to Greece and maybe even set up a colony there or something, and then obviously came back to Egypt at some point. And I think this is the confusion between Gathelos being a Greek prince. But yes, I think that the two characters involved, Skota and Gathelos, were Ankhesenamun and Pharaoh I.
Fascinating. So where does that leave us with Tut? So if we go backwards, because Ankhesenamun was married to Tut first before
yes.
she dies.
And so she was also very closely related to Tut, of course, because she was probably his first cousin.
Right. So in terms of Tut having this Western DNA, does this take us to his maternal lineage, do we think?
Well, they were all intermarried. Sorry, even more than intermarried. They were... they all married within the family. It was an incestuous relationship, of course, within Egypt. The pharaoh always married his sister or his mother or his daughter or whatever. So they were completely incestuous. So how you can separate all of these family relationships, as Zahi Hawass is proposing in this DNA analysis, I really don't know, because they were so closely related. I imagine they all had the same DNA. so I don't believe Hawass one iota when he says that he's identified who King Tut's father was, because he thinks King Tut's father is the mummy that was in KV-55. And I don't think that's true at all. He said that the father of Tutankhamun was Akhenaten, Pharaoh Akhenaten, who he identifies with this mummy in KV-55. Now, that's not possible because Akhenaten never acknowledged any son, and that's virtually impossible. Akhenaten had six daughters, and not once does he recognize that he's had a son. Now, if he had a son, he would have inscribed it everywhere in his tomb and on, you know, in his palace in Amarna, but he did not. And the reason he didn't have any sons is given to us in the Bible, and this is where we start linking the biblical material and the historical material. And of course, if you remember the Exodus account of Moses, it clearly states that the midwives acted with guile and killed all of the male heirs to the Egyptian throne. Right. And that's probably exactly what happened, because this is the very era we're talking about.
So are we saying then that even before Scotia comes to the West, that there has to have been some kind of interaction between Egypt and the Western Isles, probably for, you know, some long period of time?
No, I don't think so. It actually states that Ireland was empty at the time. It was barren land, as it were, virgin land. What happened is they went to Spain. They went to the Ebro River, which is a logical place for them to go to because it's a Nile. It's a delta region, mm-hmm. exactly the same as the Nile. But they were so harassed by the locals there that they wanted to find somewhere else, virgin land, that they could go to. One of the places they went to was Palma, Mallorca, and they stayed there for a while, or some of them did. And then another contingent, and this may have been even, you know, two or three generations later, another contingent went around the western side of Europe and landed in Ireland on the Dingle Peninsula. Now, that's entirely possible because we have no history of Ireland, of course, before this time. And Scotty Chronicon says that Ireland was pretty much uninhabited, and that's why they went there. So if we're finding a huge amount of this genetic material in that location, it's because that genetic material went from Egypt to Ireland and established itself there as the dominant DNA line in that area. So it then expanded out and was successful in that area, and that's why we find there's a predominance of that particular DNA type in Western Ireland and the west of France as well. So I think that DNA group went from Egypt to Ireland and not the other way around.
But then we still have a tut showing Western DNA. So where does that come from?
Because he went there. His descendants took the DNA from Egypt and went to Ireland. So it didn't come from Ireland. It went to Ireland.
Okay.
Because Ireland was barren at that point. It was virgin land. And he established that DNA type through his descendants in that land. And, you know, that's how DNA spreads throughout the world.
Right. Well, and for our listeners who may not be familiar with this subject, in 1955, an archaeologist from Trinity College made a fantastic discovery, which I'm sure you're well aware of, Ralph, at the Mound of Hostages at the Hill of Tara. They discovered a Bronze Age skeleton that was believed to be that of a young Egyptian prince and wearing a necklace of faience beads. And actually, the burial of this prince was very, very similar to things they found in Tut's tomb. The skeleton was carbon dated to about 1350 BC. So there have been Egyptian remains found in Ireland. And it's something that
Yes. It's
such a fascinating discovery, but nobody talks about it. Why is that?
And there are lots of similarities that I've found between Irish history and Egyptian history. Why don't they talk about it? Well, I think a lot in Ireland was because it was dominated by Catholicism at that point, and they certainly didn't want any links with Egypt. They've always been there's always been great animosity between the Jews and the Christians and having any Egyptian history. They don't seem to like it very much. And they've always denied, of course, that ancient man could actually sail, you know, through the Atlantic and arrive in Ireland. But of course, that's positively untrue, because if you look at the boat that's sitting just outside the Giza, the Great Pyramid in Giza, that could quite easily be an ocean-going boat. So there is no reason why these people could not sail the Mediterranean and the Atlantic and arrive in Ireland. So that's a facetious argument. So, yeah, I think they did travel. They could travel. They did travel. What they used at the time was they used help from the Minoans, who were the great trading nation, seagoing trading nation of that era. And they used some of the skills that they had to take them on their great exodus to Ireland. And yes, they did find this supposed Egyptian prince in the Hill of Tara. And there was a funny little story, actually, to go alongside that, because what I wanted to do is have, obviously, a photo of this necklace, this Egyptian necklace that he was wearing. So I went to the museum in Dublin, and they said no such burial was ever found. And I said, hold on a minute. I've seen this in the newspaper. It must be here somewhere. No such thing. Anyway, eventually through email, someone said, yes, oh, actually it does exist. So I asked for a picture of the necklace, and they said, no, you can't have it because one has never been taken. Bear in mind that this archaeology was done in the 1950s. This is like 50 years ago.
Right.
And for 50 years, and this is, to my mind anyway, one of the most interesting finds that's ever been made in Irish archaeology. And for 50 years, it was hidden in a cupboard in the bottom somewhere.
It's incredible. It's unfathomable that they would do that. And to this day, I've never seen a photograph of it. Has it ever been photographed?
I have one, yes. It took me 5 years to get one. And I had to make a fuss. I made a fuss. I wrote to all the newspapers there. And there was a little bit of a scandal in the newspapers. And finally, a benefactor, and I think if I remember correctly, it was someone from the Guinness family, a benefactor gave some money to the Dublin Museum so that they could photograph this and document this particular mummy and this skeleton and this archaeology, because for 50 years, the documentation had never been written up, let alone not have a photo. So finally, and this was only about last year sometime, I got my photo.
Oh, fantastic. Are you going to publish it anywhere so we can see it?
Yes, it's in the book. All of my books, probably the best way to look at these books is actually on ebooks nowadays. So I've put them all on Lulu, which is an ebook system.
Right.
And then you can download it and read it on your computer and whatever, or on a new sort of Apple iPad, all that sort of stuff.
Fantastic. Which book is it in?
This is in Skota, Egyptian Queen of the Scots.
Okay.
And the advantage of the ebooks is you can get the latest edition. Obviously, with books of this nature from myself being going through a small publisher, the editions don't turn over very quickly.
Right.
So if you want the latest edition, by far the best way is to download an ebook, and then you
That's
get
fantastic.
The latest edition.
Yeah, because I certainly have a copy of Scotia, Egyptian Queen of the Scots, but it is an older version, so I don't have that. So I will go on to Lulu.
There you go.
I will go on to Lulu, and it's worth the price of admission to see that photograph. I'm excited. And by the way, I just want to say we will put all this up on our website, thespiritrevolution.com. We'll put links to your site, links to Lulu, so that all of our listeners can do further investigation and pick up your books.
Excellent, yes. Because that's what they're there for. They're there for stimulating discussion and research, because a lot of this research should have been done by, the established hierarchies of.
but don't you find, Ralph, that the phrase "should have been done" and academia go together all the time?
Oh, don't they? Just they don't like to look at anything that is strange, slightly outside the box.
No.
They don't like anything that's too controversial, because, and I can understand it in some respects, you know, you work your way up through the ranks from postgraduate, you know, you begin to get a name and established in academia. And the last thing you want to do is go out on a limb and risk everything that you've built up in terms of your career. So it's very difficult for someone in academia to go way out on a limb like I do and say, oh, actually, you know, Skota might have come from Egypt and this might be real history and not mythology, because that is going out on a limb for academia. They don't like people challenging the establishment too much, and so they won't do it. They simply won't do it. So it does come down to people like myself, like Philip, who do this research privately, because it doesn't matter to me if someone shouts and calls names and so on. There's nothing they can do to me. They can't take away my salary. They can't take away my position. They can't take away my prestige within the archaeological environment. So I can say what I want. I can research what I want. And that makes my position much easier. And that's why I can find these things. And the establishment cannot.
And it's definitely incredible how much photography seems to cost in Ireland that you actually need a sponsor like Guinness to have photographs taken.
Yeah. So I thought that as well when they said this, that we are having to get a sponsor. But I suppose that's how things happen in academia, I suppose. You know, they have all these notes from the research they did during this archaeology, and they had to pay someone to write it all up and do all the rest of it. So anyway, that's what they did. So finally now, actually, I haven't been back there to see it, actually. They did promise it was going to be given a display case in the Dublin Museum. So I hope they have done that. I've not been back to see it yet.
Don't hold your breath, but let's hope.
No, not indeed, but I did get the picture.
But it once again shows how, you know, non-academics are able to push and rock the boat from the outside in a way that people kind of, like, you know, have to respond. And it's similar, I think, with what happened to von Däniken in the 1960s when he started to raise a big fuss about the Nazca lines, whereby he said that archaeologists were not properly investigating the Nazca lines, and that kind of, like, you know, they should. So you are rocking similarly the boat and trying to get some work done. Now, staying within this Egypt Israel to Western Europe connection, I live part time in Edinburgh. And in Edinburgh Castle, we have got the Stone of Destiny, or the Stone of Scone, which was the stone where the kings of Scotland were crowned on. The tradition, the legend goes that this is a stone which comes from Ireland, from Tara, but that before it came from Tara, it came from the Holy Land, and that this was the stone where Jacob had his dream, where he saw angels ascending and descending. It's a very similar story, and also I believe it's part of Walter Bauer's Scotochronicon, of this connection between the Mediterranean and Ireland and Scotland. So have you researched this particular aspect, and if so, where does it sit within the legend of Queen Skoda?
Well, there was a sacred stone. There was a sacred stone, whether you look at the Bible, the Quran, lots of, you know, Greek mythology. Everybody had a sacred stone. Were there lots of stones? No, I tend to think there was one stone initially. Something sacred. It was supposed to be a meteorite. And it was in Egypt. That's the origins of this story. It started in Egypt. Now, did it go with Skota in 1300 BC? Somehow I don't think so, but it's entirely possible that a stone went with Skota, ended up in Ireland, and thence into Scotland. But I don't think so, because this stone was very well documented later on, if there was only one stone, of course, if there wasn't two stones or more. Because I pick up again on this story when we come into the Roman era, because I write the story of Jesus's parentage, and this is a very complex story that I'm sure we'll go through later. And he was a grandson of Queen Cleopatra and King Phraates IV of Persia. Anyway, that's a long story. But as a part of this story, I came across the stone in the East as well. And this was a very well-known and quite well-documented showing of this stone. So this pops up in the reign of Elagabalus. He was an emperor of Rome from about 220 AD. Now, he was one of the first Perseo-Syrian emperors of Rome. And he was called Elagabalus because he worshipped the Elagabal. And the Elagabal happened to be the holy stone, the stone of Baal. And this was the same stone. This is the same stone that we're talking about, as far as I can see. This is the same stone that was worshipped by Jacob, that became the Omphalos stone of Greece, and then somehow it ended up in Syria. And Emperor Elagabalus took it to Rome, where it had a complete temple made for it. And we know this because it was on all of his coinage, so we even know what it looks like. So it was a conical stone, somewhere in the region of a meter and a half high, maybe a meter wide at the base, and a cone. And it was identified with a phoenix. It always had the symbol of the phoenix written on the side of it. And this was, as far as I can see, the Stone of Scone. Now, it was in Rome until about 230 AD when Elagabalus was killed. He was a bit of a strange emperor. We'll probably go through his history later on. Anyway, he was deposed and killed. And we don't know what happened to the stone after that. Now, I have a theory, and the reasons why we'll have to run through later again, because it's very complex, that the stone actually ended up in Chester in England, along with Jesus, but we'll go through that, why that happened later. And this is the stone that became known as the Holy Grail. Well, the Grail had many facets, but if you read the Vulgate cycle, which is the great seven books of the Arthurian legend, the original Arthurian legend, one of the aspects of the Holy Grail was as a stone. And if you go around the cathedrals of Europe, you will quite often see Jesus holding a Grail cup, and inside the Grail cup will be a stone. So again, this was an aspect of the Holy Grail. So the Holy Stone was something very close to and to do with the Holy Grail. So what happened to it after its very short, well, actually, it wasn't too short, sojourn in Chester. I think it was probably in Chester for about 200 years or so. So somewhere between 200 AD and 400 AD, when the Roman Empire in Britain collapsed. Then we don't know what happened to it. And the question is, where did it go to after that? Well, we have that there are no concrete sightings of it after that. And so it is quite possible that it ended up in Scotland, of course. That might have been a refuge for it when Roman England was collapsing. So that's what I think happened to this sacred stone. And I think it was just one stone. It was meteoric in some fashion. It was deemed to be sacred. It was deemed to be very special. And the reason I think it was deemed to be special was because it was a magnet. It was metallic and magnetic. And this, I think, is the reason we get for the story of the sword in the stone, you remember from Arthurian legend. And in Arthurian legend, nobody could take their swords off the stone except for Arthur. And Arthur came along and took his sword away just like that. Well, it specifically says, if you read Eisenbach's Parsifal, it specifically says that the attendants of the Grail stone had to use silver knives. And, of course, silver knives will not be attracted to a magnetic stone. So I think that is the history behind the sword in the stone. The reason why Arthur could withdraw his sword so easily was because it was non-ferrous.
I have never heard that. That is so fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I like to sort of put a different edge on a lot of this mythology, because as you said, and I said before, there has to be a reason for the mythology being made. I think anyway, that there is a real historical reason behind all of this mythology. So where does this mythology came from? What were they trying to interpret in their rudimentary fashion, 1,000, 2,000 years ago? Well, if you had this big lump of magnetic material and it was doing something very strange, in Parsifal, they said it ate stone. It ate iron. Iron was its food, its sustenance, and it ate iron. Well, that's a fairly good description of a very good magnet, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And so this is where I think this mythology comes from. There is a historical essence to every piece of mythology.
And definitely something else which the Stone of Destiny and the Grail share is the fact that the Stone of Destiny was said to have inscriptions on its edge, which the current one on display in Edinburgh doesn't have. And there's lots of stories about how the one which is currently on display is not the real one at all.
Yes, it's somehow a fake.
Have you got any ideas or suspicions or theories or clues as to where the real one might be?
Well, some people have said it is buried where they originally buried it, which is in the original capital of Egypt, of Scotland, which you will be able to remind me is
Scone itself.
Yes, but there's a certain abbey there with there's an abbey there that it was supposed to have been buried in originally, and I can't remember its name.
There was an abbey right next to the Palace of Scone. So.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe there. That was one possibility that I heard of. Robbie, I've just forgotten his name, was telling me about another history of it recently, that it was hidden somewhere in someone's cellar, and it was still viewable to members of the Masonic hierarchy in Scotland. And he had this wonderful picture that someone had made, it was something somebody had made up of a small video of this stone elevating itself, because it was supposed to have powers of levitation. So this little stone elevates itself and wanders across the room. So that little video clip is on the net somewhere, I'm sure.
Oh, I want to see that. Okay, before I really want to get into some of the Arthurian stuff and the connections to Jesus. But before we do that, I want to go back to the Amarna period while we're still here, because one of the things that you write about that I'd love to have you talk about for a minute is this idea that Eden and Egypt are the same, that Eden actually, the Garden of Eden actually stems from what we know about the Amarna period, that Adam and Eve were Akhenaten and Nefertiti. And I have a two-part question. The first question is, I think, a fairly simple one. Is the reason that it is so difficult to get real information about Amarna because so much of it was deliberately destroyed, is the first question. And the second question is, where then do you go to come to this conclusion about Amarna and the Garden of Eden?
Yes, well, that was, I'm just scribbling down here. That was a very interesting part of my research, because I'd done so much of this research previously, that was indicating that the Israelites were Egyptians, that the patriarchs were pharaohs of Egypt. So there was this big link between Israelites and Egypt, and therefore the Torah itself, the Tanakh, the Bible, was a book that came out of Egypt. In my estimation, it was actually the day book, they used to call it, the diary of the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. So this was the book that detailed all of the aspects of the royal court. It detailed who the people were, who they were marrying, who their children were, what major events happened within their reign. That is the Tanakh as we know it, the Bible. But one of the things I couldn't look at or didn't want to look at initially was the Genesis story, because, I mean, it's the first bit of the Bible. It's just, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I didn't think there was any way that you could pull real history out of the Genesis story, because there's just not enough information there. And maybe we're going back too far anyway, you know, in terms, in historical terms. But then as I was looking at it, the first thing I noticed was the description of the Garden of Eden. And of course, the Garden of Eden had a river that ran through it, which then branched into four branches. Now, there is only one river in the whole of the Middle East that does that, and that's the Nile. The Nile runs through an oasis, the ribbon oasis of Egypt, and then it branches into four branches in the Nile Delta. There is no other river that does that.
Right.
And so that was an obvious clue that we were looking to Egypt again. And it just struck me that maybe this Genesis story is not a Genesis story. It's not a beginning of the world, of mankind. It's not a creation myth. Because I sat there and read it and thought, I recognize this. I've read this before. I've read this in Egypt. Because it is, it's a copy, it's a direct copy, if you look at it. It's a direct copy of the Hymn to the Aten, which is the great, not a creation myth, this is a dawning of the new day eulogy created by Pharaoh Akhenaten himself. And it's in his tomb, you can read it in his tomb. And so this wasn't a celebration of the creation of the world, it was a celebration of the creation of a new day. So when it says the sun appeared, it's not because the sun was just made, it's because it appeared over the horizon. And the birds, they sort of stretch their wings and begin to sing, and all of creation comes to life. But not comes to life as in terms was just being created, mm-hmm. but comes to life because they were asleep and now they're waking up. Yeah? It is the Hymn to the Aten. It's identical. And if you understand that, then you suddenly understand the Genesis story.
Well,
because the two lovebirds of the Garden of Eden were Adam and Eve, of course, who were naked and unashamed, living in the Garden of Eden. And of course, if you look at the Amarna story, you have the exact same events, because you have Pharaoh Akhenaten and his wife Nefertiti who were always naked, living in the Garden of Aten. Not the Garden of Eden, but the Garden of Aten. And of course, the Garden of Aten was the garden to their god. Their god was called the Aten. And so the Garden of Eden is Amarna itself. Amarna is the Garden of Eden. It is the garden that they created within their palace at Amarna, which was called the Garden of Aten.
So take us to the next stage, which is what happens with the apple.
Well, that is difficult to interpret, but I think we can see what was going on if we look at the Temple of Karnak. Because in the Temple of Karnak, you will see the great tree of remembrance. And on the tree of remembrance are the cartouches of the pharaohs. So, there is a nice detail of Thoth, the god Thoth, inscribing, because he was the god of writing, of course. Thoth is inscribing the cartouches of the pharaohs on the fruits of the tree and placing those fruits upon the tree. So the fruits hanging on the tree are a record of the pharaohs of Egypt, of the dynasties of Egypt. It is a family tree, exactly as we say today. You have a family tree, it's the names of your family. But this was actually on a real tree. You can see this big tree with fruits, and each fruit has the cartouche of a pharaoh on it. And so I think when we're talking about Eve plucking the fruits from the Tree of Remembrance, because that's what it's called, actually. In the Tanakh, it's called the Tree of Remembrance. Well, in fact, there were two trees, but one of them was called the Tree of Remembrance. I think we're talking about possibly them as a new dynasty usurping the old dynasty and deleting the old pharaohs from the Tree of Remembrance. Or possibly even, because we know that Akhenaten did this, deleting the old gods from the Tree of Remembrance. Remember, Akhenaten was the first of the monotheists. Right. He was the pharaoh who tried to delete all of the old gods completely and instate the one true, as he said, god, the Aten. And maybe it is this deletion of the old gods that they were talking about when they were saying, you know, do not eat of the fruits of the old tree and all this sort of business. I think it is something to do with the Tree of Remembrance as displayed in the Temple of Karnak.
Now, you've hinted at it before, that this Akhenaten Moses period, you're not the first. There have been people like Sigmund Freud who have been delving into this. Ahmed Osman is a somewhat more recent example. How do you see this extremely complex period of history, and how do you see Egyptian history fitting in with Jewish history, or vice versa?
It fits precisely. The only thing you need to know is that there were two exoduses. And there is a hint, if you look at the Tanakh, that there was two exoduses. But in essence, the Bible has conflated these two exodus events into one. So in reality, there were two exoduses. The first exodus was the great exodus of the Hyksos people. And just if your listeners are not aware of who the Hyksos were, they were the pharaohs of northern Egypt, of lower Egypt, who set up a separate dynasty to southern Egypt. And there was a bit of a civil war between the two sides. And eventually the Hyksos were expelled on a great exodus. This is real history, by the way. This doesn't come from the Bible. And the interesting thing about these Hyksos is the story is the same. So, well, let's have a look at a few of the points. They were known as shepherds. One of their kings was called Jacob. They wore earrings and they were circumcised. They were involved in a war with the Egyptians. And then suddenly there were storms, floods, darkness for several days. The plagues were sent upon them. And then 500,000 of these people, these shepherds, were forced out of Egypt. And they went from Pi-Ramesse in northern Egypt, and they fled to Jerusalem. Now, doesn't that sound like a familiar story. What I've just been talking about doesn't come from the Bible. That comes from real history. This is the history of the Hyksos people as we know it, as given to us also by Manetho, the Egyptian historian. It's the same story. Absolutely the same story. So the major thing we know about about the Exodus is that the major Exodus, the great Exodus, was the Exodus of the Hyksos people. And this occurred in about 1600 BC. But there was another Exodus out of Egypt. And that was the Exodus of Akhenaten and his followers, the Amarna era. So now we're talking 300 years later, about 1320 BC, when Akhenaten and his followers. Now, again, in Egyptian history, they will say that Akhenaten died, but there is no evidence that Akhenaten died in Egypt. I think he was kicked out of Egypt on an exodus. And this is, again, coming to the Skota story, because this is exactly the same era. Akhenaten would have been kicked out in about 1320 BC. 1320 BC. And Pharaoh I, Gathelos, would have been kicked out in about 1300 BC, 1310 BC, about 10 years afterwards. So we're talking about exactly the same era. There was another exodus out of Egypt. And this was the much smaller exodus, as Manetho calls it, of the lepers and maimed priests who fled Egypt in about this time. And this is where I think that we get the main characters from for the Exodus story. So the main Exodus occurred 300 years previously. But then the characters that we are familiar with are the characters from the Amarna era. So Moses, for instance, was, I believe, the brother of Akhenaten, mainly because his name was called Moses. So this is always a good reason. Yeah. So the two main characters of the Exodus story, Aaron and Moses, were actually Akhenaten and his brother Moses.
So in Manetho's account, when he talks about lepers and maimed priests, do you think this idea of the maimed priests comes from the fact that the Amarna priests were considered essentially heretics by the other Egyptians?
Yes. Okay. Of course, yeah, because this was the main heresy that Egypt had ever endured. Akhenaten was the man who went around all of Egypt with his army, cutting the images and the names of the gods out of all the temples. I mean, you can imagine the turmoil in the land. You know, if you can imagine an army running around Europe, going into every Catholic cathedral and chopping down all of the images of Mary and Jesus and all of the images of Jesus sitting on a crucifix. I mean, there would be turmoil in the land, would there not? You know, but this is what Akhenaten did. He went round and cut out all of the images of the gods. So yes, of course he was a heretic. Of course he was a leper, not a real leper, of course. This is just a theological leper, of course. So yes, they called him a leper and a maimed priest. And these were the people who were kicked out of Egypt in the smaller of the two exoduses.
And then the same thing happens to him, right? I mean, he is stricken from the records and he is carved out of everything. And therefore, Absolutely. We have very, very little archaeological remnant of Amarna, correct?
They dismantled everything. They took the whole of Amarna apart, brick by brick. In fact, even more than that, they took his bricks down to Karnak and they put them as hardcore in the center of their pylon. So they would be hidden forever. And they put them upside down as well.
Mm. So
he was not liked at all.
Now, for our listeners who are interested in this subject, am I correct in saying that your book, Eden in Egypt, is the best starting place for this?
Possibly, but I think they should go back to the first book I wrote, which was Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs. That was a sort of broad brush look at the entire history of the Bible, the Tanakh. Because I had these same ideas all the way back in the mid 1990s. So that ran through the whole of the biblical story. And then I went back with subsequent books and I picked out specific events and specific points I wanted to research deeper. So then we went through Tempest and Exodus, which obviously looks at the Exodus and finds quotations from Egyptian stelae in the Bible, or vice versa, actually, as it were. The Bible may have been copying them. Then it looked at Eden in Egypt, which is, of course, about Pharaoh, Akhenaten, and Nefertiti being Adam and Eve. And then it went through to Solomon, Pharaoh of Egypt, because if all of these patriarchs, or all of these famous characters from the early Bible were Egyptians, then surely some of the later history of Israel also might be linked to Egypt. And indeed it is, because I don't think they left Egypt as such until 500 BC. So most of Israelite history is Egyptian history. It's just that they don't want you to know that. I think they, because there was an amount of persecution, they took on the persecution complex, because it's a very successful ploy. They've done the same with Jesus as well. Oh, he was just a lowly carpenter. Mm-hmm. No, he wasn't.
No, he wasn't.
And so again, this persecution complex is very successful. You don't want to say, oh, we were persecuted, but we were mighty pharaohs of Egypt.
Right.
Because that doesn't sort of wash, does it? You want to say, oh, we were persecuted because we were just lowly shepherds. That's a much better story.
Well, I guess my question for you, and we're going to go into another hour of this, and we're going to talk about some of these really fascinating theories that you have about Jesus and his origins, and my favorite subject, Mary Magdalene. But before we do that, I guess I want to close on this question. You know, all three of us have written very controversial material and have certainly dealt with the repercussions. My question for you is, a lot of what you're writing is very controversial for many people. How much heat have you taken about the controversy?
Lots. Luckily, it doesn't translate into direct violence, but I have had many a threat. People get upset. It's challenging their view of life. It's challenging their entire belief system. You know, some people have been brought up, especially if you look at Islam, the Catholic Church as well. This is a very deeply seated, deeply rooted belief system that they've had ever since they were age 2 or 3. It's very difficult to challenge that and not provoke some sort of response. And yes, sometimes it does provoke a very, well, I wouldn't say violent, but potentially violent response. But the thing that astounded me was that some of the worst abuse I got was actually from Egyptologists.
Mm.
And I found that very strange. I thought they'd be more open-minded. But again, we come back to this business of the establishment being very rigid, and people don't want to go outside the rigid structure that they have set up. And so they get offended and they get annoyed, even though I'm not actually changing any of Egyptian history, really. I have the same chronology. I have the same people, the same events pretty much all the way through. The only thing I'm saying is actually these people are linked to biblical people. And they don't like that. And I had some terrible emails back from some of these chaps. But the funny thing was they were unable to defend themselves, because they might know a great deal about Egypt, but they've obviously never read the Bible. So I could run rings around these people. It was quite amazing, you know. So, but it was very interesting debating, because it gave me confidence that what I was writing about and saying was correct, because they could not pick any holes whatsoever in my thesis.
And it's probably how we have come full circle to the beginning, whereby we were introduced to this oblique reference to the fact that there is DNA analysis on King Tut, suggesting, if not showing, if not proving, that he has got this Western European origin. Ralph Ellis is our guest this week. He will be our guest next week once again. Ralph, your books are available via Lulu and various other websites. Your website itself is edfubooks.com. Thank you for being our guest, and until next.
And I would just like to point out as well that the hardback copies, because I must plug Mr. Hatcher Childress. The hardback copies, the paper copies, are still available in Adventures Unlimited, and he's done a sterling service with keeping my American sales going. So if you're in America, Adventures Unlimited.
So from Kathleen and I, welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. Until next week,
the truth against the world.